Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. I sent you a picture of something exciting the other day of me meeting Mike Batt.
Yes.
Underground, Overground, Wombling Free, the man who wrote all the Wombles hits and was inside, I think, some of the Wombles.
He was inside the Wombles?
The costumes.
Wow.
Yeah, there was nothing untoward going on.
No.
I was interviewing him about the Beatles for this American radio show I was doing, and I was in...
Underground, Overground, Wombling Free.
Where do you think he lives?
The Wombles of Wimbledon.
He lives in Wimbledon. If you were the man behind the Wombles,
he didn't invent the Wombles.
No, that was a woman, I think, called Elizabeth Beresford, who was the author of it. He just was asked to write the theme music to the TV show.
Who was your favourite Womble?
I think I liked Tobermory. Maybe Orinoco. How about you?
I was going to say Orinoco. Great Uncle Bulgaria.
Very good, yeah. Madame
Chalet. I think probably the names were just brilliant.
Well, that's when a baby Womble is born, they stick a pin in a map, and that's where they get the name from.
Is that right?
I think so. I mean, they've dug that up from the dark recesses of my memory somewhere.
And Bernard Cribbins was the narrator.
I'd love to meet Bernard Cribbins. All right, what are we talking about this week then?
Well, this week we're talking about the repair movement and an idea called the right to repair. Our consumption of electronics is rapidly increasing, and I speak, as we'll hear on the episode, from personal experience, as people buy more phones, computers and electrical appliances. In fact, I think this applies to us both. 50 million tons of electronic waste is produced globally each year, and this is expected to more than double by 2050. And part of the problem is the difficulty of repairing products means it can be cheaper to replace them than fix them, with a massive impact on waste, resource use and carbon emissions. The right to repair is the idea that manufacturers should be forced to make products that are repairable. Last year, the EU passed world-leading legislation on it, and a number of countries are challenging the tactics being used to encourage consumers to replace products more frequently. We're talking to Adèle Chasson, who's part of a campaign in France that led to Apple being fined €25 million for deliberately slowing down old iPhones. Janet Gunter from the Restart Project, which runs Restart Parties to help people repair their products, and also campaigns on the right to repair, and Duncan McCann, who's been thinking about these issues at the New Economics Foundation.
Hey, are you one for rolling your sleeves up and repairing things? Pencil behind your ear, toolkit out.
It's not really me, is it?
When you were growing up, was your dad one for fixing things?
My dad
was always fixing things, and a way in which he'd fix my toys often was by sticking a knife into the gas fire until it was really hot, and then melting plastic toys back together so they all looked horribly deformed.
So it's funny, we don't really produce much of a hypothesis, do we? Because you had a dad that would repair things, and you can't repair for toffee, and I had a dad that couldn't repair things, and I can't repair for toffee either.
So society's to blame, is what you're saying?
Well, I don't know. I mean, something maybe it's genetics or, you know, something.
Yeah.
It's a good issue, isn't it?
Yeah. And then we're joined this week, live on tape from Hollywood, it's the Larry Sanders Show.
Hey now.
Larry Sanders is going to be our guest.
Now, but unfortunately, it's not Gary Shandling, who sadly died.
R.I.P. Yeah. But it is an exciting guest. Do you want to tell us about the other Larry Sanders?
Yes, it's Bernie Sanders' brother, Larry Sanders. Larry, who's 84... is the older brother of Bernie, who's 78. Larry grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and has lived in the UK since 1969. He was a Green Party councillor, and he's currently the Green Party spokesperson for health and social care. But we're going to be really mainly talking to him about all things Bernie.
Wow.
Feeling the burn.
So that's what's coming up on this week's episode. We should just mention that there'll be another book club coming out in the next couple of days. But we're accumulating quite the back catalogue now, aren't we?
Quite the oeuvre.
Yes.
We've had Ian McEwan and his novel Machines Like Me. I really enjoyed that conversation with Ian. US-based TV host Rachel Maddow and her book Blowout about the oil and gas industry, which is, I think, a really great book, and it's a really interesting conversation that we had with our Michael Lewis.
One of the finest nonfiction writers in the world.
Author of The Fifth Risk, Rana Faruha, Don't Be Evil, her book about big tech, Mariana Mazzucato. I'm really proud of the really interesting people we've had on. It's got its own feed. Do listen, do rate and review it, preferably well. So what's your reason to be cheerful?
Speedo Mick.
Go on.
I was covering on BBC Radio 5 Live the
You've read me all the celebrities. This, honestly.
I met Speedo Mick, who is a man who walked from Land's End to John O'Groats in just a pair of Speedos. He's just finished that walk. He was still wearing the Speedos.
Was that before or after you interviewed the skateboarding dog?
He's raised £340,000
Well, you interviewed
charity.
Him just in Speedos and a hat.
I mean, it was quite remarkable. He came into the studios at about 6:30 in the morning, just in Speedos and a woolly hat, having walked from Land's End to John O'Groats. Yeah, he just got the idea in his head, and he came in, and I can now say I've met Speedo Mick. How about you? What's your reason to be cheerful?
What mine is, it's sort of got its own reason to be cheerful, but then it's sort of given me an idea. So, you know, we've talked on the podcast before about Designated Survivor.
Yes.
Did you know that there is a Korean version of Designated Survivor? I mean, I sort of made me wonder, maybe we should be franchising Reasons to be Cheerful.
If anybody wants to get in touch, yeah.
I mean, clearly we're the English language version, but I think we'd be sort of hard-pressed to do the Korean language version.
Yeah, definitely. Let's have our people talk to their people. Do we have people?
Well, not
we
really.
We should get a person.
Yeah, but don't you think there's a sort of franchising possibility? And now, the reason I say this is because I was with an Italian friend, and she was saying that podcasts aren't really a thing in Italy. And in fact, she's a documentary maker, and she was saying that they did this pitch for this documentary, and the person they were pitching to said, well, we're not so keen on it being a TV documentary, but it could be a podcast. And she was rather insulted by this.
Right.
And I said that she shouldn't be insulted, and she should become the queen of Italian podcasting.
Definitely. And we should get a little franchise fee.
Definitely.
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
So with us now, we have Janet Gunter, who is co-founder of the Restart Project, and Duncan McCann making a return appearance on the podcast, senior researcher at the New Economics Foundation. Hello, both.
Hello.
So, Janet, let's start with you. You're wearing a Restart T-shirt. Tell us about the Restart Project and the story behind it.
Yeah, so we got started about 6 or 7 years ago, and we heard about this thing in Holland called the Repair Cafe movement. But I'd been talking about with a colleague of mine who's been working in global development, so, you know, bringing technology into really amazing social change projects in Africa and Latin America, about how wrong our use of technology started to feel, you know, back home. And so we'd been kind of discussing this for quite a while, this notion that, you know, that not only are we wasting things, but we're just not really fully appreciating them and using them to their fullest. And so we wanted to focus on things with batteries and plugs, because we felt like that was the, you know, that was one of the worst kind of examples of the way we use things. And also just because we really actually we have a background in technology, like the early internet. We used to love technology. So we started hosting these events in our back garden in Camden and down in Lambeth, where I live.
And what happens at these events? What are they?
So basically, as you can imagine, there's loads of people with broken stuff everywhere who are super frustrated. But what we didn't know is that every neighborhood has like super enthusiastic people who want to share their fixing skills. So the whole thing just basically snowballed. We invited people. We didn't know how many fixers would come, you know, how much we could actually really fix. And more people came to our first event than we could ever imagine who wanted to volunteer.
Right. So these are the local fixers.
Yeah. Well, and some came from across London.
And what did people bring?
People bring all sorts. You know, it's a lot of the stuff is just the stuff that keeps people connected. So it's laptops, it's mobiles, it's tablets. But as you can imagine, there's a lot of kitchen appliances, a lot of like hi-fi kit that people really love and want to keep. And then we get toys and all kinds of, you know, silly stuff as well. Yeah.
Because Janet set out in a way the solution, some of the solutions. Talk to us about the scale of the problem of electronic waste and why it should sort of bother us.
Well, I think the scale is just something that's almost beyond imagination. So it's one of the fastest growing kind of waste streams that we have. And it's a waste stream that is particularly problematic because, one, it contains loads of potentially harmful materials, especially things like batteries, but also when stuff gets old, it has lead, it can have cadmium in it. This stuff is poisonous once it gets out into the environment, so we need to kind of treat it properly. And then on the other side, there's also that it's a hugely growing, you know, technology, electronics is integrating into more and more of our stuff. And so more and more of what we use on a day-to-day basis, of what makes our life kind of modern, is electronics. And so those two things combined mean that it's something that we really do have to take note of.
I've got a shameful confession.
Well, I was about to say, don't we need to declare our situation here.
My printer recently had a paper jam.
Right.
I like tried to unjam it. I couldn't. Every time I switched it back on, it said paper jam. So I just bought a new printer.
Well, printers are one of the perfect examples. Printers are almost always sold at next to nothing. Where they get you is the ink, because ultimately they're going to make their money after the fact. Exactly.
And Ed is holding up his three mobile phones.
I mean, I think we should have full declaration here. So there's the iPhone 5, which was originally mine, or is mine, actually. Then there's your iPhone 8. So I was doing quite well because I recycled yours.
Yes.
But then it got...
I've got a drawer full of old phones.
But then it got really suffered during the election campaign. I mean, that wasn't just me. And it got very waterlogged, and so it got these lines on it. So I've now succumbed to the iPhone 11. So I'm really... I mean, we'll come on to our own responsibility as well as the manufacturers.
But what happened? So when I think about when I was growing up, there were things like TV repair shops everywhere. And then it just seemed to get to a point where people didn't get stuff repaired anymore. Because, I mean, it's not like these objects are that cheap, but they're often the cost of repair feels negligible.
So it used to be that, you know, that people who fixed televisions had access to schematics, to repair manuals, and they had access to, you know, original parts from manufacturers. All of that has been massively scaled back. And so it's really hard, just like it is for us to do in a DIY or community setting, really hard for professionals to make a living. And it makes it that much more inconvenient for the average person to go out and find a repair.
And I think there is evidence, isn't there, that this has speeded up. I mean, I just think back to my childhood. We had a black and white telly until I was probably... Stop laughing, Joel. We had a black...
He's Googling black and white TV. We had
a black and white telly until I must have been 9 or 10 or even a bit, maybe a bit older. And then we bought a colour telly. And then we had that for like 15 years. Until I had grown up and left home. Doesn't that your recollection?
Yeah, definitely. And is it that things aren't built to last? Or is it this? I mean,
you wouldn't replace a telly every 2 years, for example.
The cost has been squeezed out of them. So I'll give you a good example of what fails in televisions often is capacitors. Like really, they're like the size of, they're an inch or less. And they cost, you know, next to nothing. But manufacturers have been cutting costs and using ones that have been shown to be faulty sometimes and not giving, you know, adequate thought to that. And so the consequence of that is, I mean, literally a part that costs less than 20p is causing you to move on to the next telly.
Is there evidence that people are replacing stuff more often than they used to? I mean, I know the stuff is different, but
I think definitely. I mean, I think the phone is the perfect example. So I have a phone. I've had it for 3 years, and every couple of months I get a call from my provider encouraging me to take out what they term a free upgrade, but, you know, is actually something that I'm paying for over the course of 24 months.
Well, phones are interesting, though, because phones, like, phone lifetime seem to have, like, plummeted and got and reached, like, almost like a rock bottom, but they're coming back up again. And that's why there's a big battle with manufacturers over this right to repair, because they're seeing as a threat, as an existential threat to their business model. So, but with household appliances, definitely there's a whole body of academic research that shows that the product lifetime have decreased. So, you know, it is true what everyone's experiencing at home. It's been proven.
And let's talk about planned obsolescence, because that is, I mean, this is not accidental. It's not just, you know, I mean, Jeff's a klutz, but it's not just, as am I, but it's not just about people who are klutzes who kind of, you know, spill water into their thing or whatever. It's a conspiracy.
Well,
I mean, I'll make a declaration. So my declaration, I used to work for Cisco Systems for 10 years. And so I was responsible.
You're part of the conspiracy.
I was responsible for their global end of life strategy for a number of years.
Go on. Tell us.
And, you know, as designers, when people are designing products, people are making choices. And so the decision about those capacitors, those little items, and when designers are speccing out what to fill their products with, each of those components comes with like a mean time between failure, which is like how long they expect the average life cycle of this product, this particular component, to last. And as designers and as most, especially around consumer electronics, it was less a pressure for Cisco because we're selling high-end business-to-business equipment that is expected to last 10 to 20 years. So we weren't at kind of the sharp end of some of this. But when you're trying to design something at the cost point of £20, £30, which much of our electronic equipment is priced at, you're necessarily squeezing that design cost. And so designers are making active decisions to put in components that have low life cycles.
But at the request of, like, executives, let's be clear. Because designers and engineers are absolutely up for the challenge of making longer-lasting products. And we hear it from them all the time.
Yeah. And what do you think it is that... Because it's not, I mean, maybe capitalists have become more
greedy,
cutthroat. But, you know, it's not like 30 years ago people wouldn't have realized if they could persuade people to buy new things, it would be better for them than them being repaired. What's changed in this, do you think?
So the mobile is such a great example, right? It's like the ultimate emblem of, like, this kind of, I must, you know, upgrade. Upgrading used to be making the thing you had better. But at some point, upgrading just became throwing that thing out and getting another one. And the mobile is very much an emblem of that. But we're starting to treat televisions the same way. And so, you know, I really think actually it was the way that they pushed out this kind of constant refresh cycle of the mobile that really changed a lot.
It's amazing that people used to queue up for, say, a record release, and then we got to a point 10 years ago where people were queuing up outside the shop for the latest iPhone. And I got to a point, I mean, I don't upgrade every model now, but I got to a point where I was so obsessed by it. If they'd have just put the exact same phone in a slightly cooler design, I would have got it, because it was the design I wanted, not the functionality.
And I'm sure Apple's not the only offender, but it's particularly notorious, isn't it? The iPhone business.
For sure. I mean, there was the battery gate, and there have been a couple other instances where Apple is essentially lining itself up to use software to lock down its products, whereby if any independent were to go in, or DIYer were to go in and try and fix something, it trips like a software, you know, kind of block. And that is really, you know, that's potentially really harmful and dangerous. And then Apple's just been the most visible in lobbying against, in every stage, the right to repair. So they're kind of setting themselves up for it, too.
So what is the right to repair, then?
Well, it's kind of all the things we've been discussing. So time was, you know, you could find the tools around, and you could find a schematic or something to help you repair something. And you didn't have to worry about a software lockdown or a copyright from some company. You just were able to take the thing you own and repair it. And that's what we, you know, we're pushing for again, is some of the things we had before.
And there is some EU regulation that's been introduced. What's that?
Yeah, well, last year it's a groundbreaking regulation. In the U.S., the right to repair movement kind of sprung up first, and it was kind of more like a cowboy kind of, let us repair the things we own, you know, damn it, that kind of thing. Whereas the EU approached it from a slightly different perspective, which is, you know, this consumption is destroying the planet. And so they came at it from a kind of eco angle. And they, you know, those labels on the white goods on appliances that talk about eco efficiency, well, they've included the whole of the life cycle of the appliance in that. So that means that we have to take into account manufacture and the length of the life cycle of things. And so it's game changing. And so last year they passed this regulation for design for repair, among other things.
And what will that mean in practice, do you think?
Yeah, in practice, it
could... For an iPhone, for example, would it change things?
Well, that's the next... So those were just for a couple of white goods, a couple of, you know, iconic, like your washing machine,
so it's got to be repairable,
dishwasher,
basically.
Yeah, but we're fighting for that to be expanded to all the other stuff we've just been talking about for this year, yeah.
And what impact will Brexit have on this, if anything? Are we going to have even stronger regulation around right to repair?
Well, the good thing is it's probably unlikely that they will choose to spend any time kind of specifically deregulating it. So, you know, on the transition day, all the regulations will transfer over that are applicable to the UK. But over the long term, it's hard to see that that this government is going to, you know, beef up some of those regulatory obligations.
Well, and continue to stay aligned with them. So we're, you know, some of the stuff we're campaigning for now, which is, you know, right to repair for smartphones, you know, better laptops, all of that, we won't benefit because it's coming down the line.
And if we were being optimistic, we're obviously not tied to the EU in regulations the same way, which could have significant downsides. But if we wanted to go further, what would we do? How would we go better than the right to repair?
Well, I know straight away. So the ones that passed last year, the access to spare parts and repair documentation are only really going to be made available to what they call professionals. And we think that DIYers and community repair should have access as well. So that's simple.
And going beyond these white goods into smartphones.
Absolutely. And we know that they're, you know, DEFRA's interested in that.
What do the manufacturers say about all this?
Well, I think externally they're talking about this information being proprietary, that they talk the narrative of kind of consumer protection. What about all these people that are just going to at their home be dismantling all this stuff? There's current, there's electricity going through this, all the dangers, be careful, be careful, be careful. I think those are some of the kind of the external narratives. But I think it's more interesting kind of what these companies are more talking about internally. And there it's really about hitting the bottom line. I wrote an article kind of last year, and a sales drop in Apple is specifically linked to some of these kind of repairing, people using their iPhones for longer.
Basically, what their tune is, it's like the opposite of your podcast. It's like reasons to be fearful. So it's like, you know, you're going to...
Very good. That'll be our sequel.
Well, yeah, you're going to, you know, you're going to poke your battery and, you know, chaos will ensue.
Let's say that people use their iPhones, smartphones, whatever, for longer. What difference can that make to climate and carbon emissions?
Yeah, well, this is one of the things that, you know, is hidden from us when we buy things, is the carbon impact that's gone into manufacture. And while, you know, maybe 72 kilos of carbon per device doesn't seem that much, if you multiply it at the scale of like 200 million in Europe or almost 2 billion phones globally, it starts to get really big. So I believe the European Environmental Bureau estimated something like if you extend the life cycle of phones, I believe it's just a year, all the phones, you get in the magnitude of, is it 2 million cars off the road?
We're talking about big numbers here.
Yeah.
You know, maybe we think about, you know, let's not leave our phones charging if they're already charged up or whatever, but actually nearly three quarters of the environmental cost of our phones is the manufacture and the disposal, not the actual use.
Yeah, so that's the thing about, so with some of the heating and cooling equipment, or maybe your gigantic television, we have to take into account...
How do you know?
I just seem like the time.
Yeah.
The use is significant, right? Because you're heating and cooling, or you're using a big screen. But with the smaller stuff, it's absolutely like upwards of 70, 80% of the energy ever used is used in its production. So it has a big consequence. And the other thing about recycling is that we're not recycling everything. So when we recycle this stuff, we just basically throw it in a big shredder. And we can get a lot of the materials out, but not the ones like some of the ones like tantalum, some of the ones like rare earths that are extremely environmentally taxing to mine. And so we're just literally just mining them, using them, throwing them.
It'd be good to talk about the role of us as consumers in this, because clearly the manufacturers are highly responsible and culpable here. But I sort of feel like, don't we need to sort of, I'm looking at you, obviously.
All right. So my vacuum cleaner's broken. What do I do instead of going and buying a new one?
I suppose maybe it's more. Isn't it also that we are, you know, we've become, you know, sort of just kind of conspicuous consumers, haven't we?
So like you're hooked on having the latest thing.
Yeah.
So we have to change our behavior.
I guess I'm asking about that.
But I really think that it, like, we need to, while we can take some responsibility, yeah, we always need to look at the system because, you know, so why is it that it's hard for you to source a spare part for your vacuum cleaner?
Honestly, I went on Google. I mean, I wouldn't know where to begin fixing a vacuum cleaner. Look at these hands. They've never done a day's work in their life, as my dad will often tell me. But I wouldn't know where to begin. And I typed in the brand of the vacuum cleaner and then my neighborhood into Google, and I couldn't find anything that didn't look like some kind of weird aggregator sort of repair site that I'd,
well, just to say, if you're in London, we've been working on a repair directory for reliable businesses. So go check that out if you're in London.
So what would I search? Restart?
Yeah, yeah. But also, you know, we just need to look at that, those system level issues. So, you know, and why is it, for example, that you don't know the expected lifetime of that vacuum when you're buying it?
I mean, I think it is true to say that if I think about Jeff's iPhone 8, which became my iPhone 8, if I could have got rid of the lines from the water damage and got the button to be working, or even actually just got rid of the lines, I would probably have carried on with it.
Whereas I'm looking at your new phone and I can see that it's got three little lenses on the camera at the back, and I think, why hasn't mine got three? I want three. So in the coming utopia of the Jeffocracy, if I was to make you both in charge of some kind of ministry for repair, I mean, pick what you want.
It's a good name for ministry of repair, isn't it?
There we go.
Repair ministry.
Yeah. What is the first thing you would do around this on day one?
We know that manufacturers have so much information about their products. So I guess the first thing we'd like to know is, how long have you predicted this product will last? And while we're at it, tell us about the environmental impacts in production, because they have this information. And if I have the ability to do anything, just anything at all, right away, that's the thing I'd like to see, is just force them to publish it. There's so many other things I'd love, but that's a starting.
Publish and be damned.
Yeah, and one thing that I'd like to do is kind of put an impact on government procurement, so that all that government procurement would have to be with manufacturers. And there are manufacturers, we haven't really mentioned them today, who do focus on repair, because that can really drive a market.
Give us an example.
Well, I mean, the kind of the laptop, the PC laptop world is a world that's kind of really comfortable with taking things apart, upgrades, and there are specific manufacturers, you know, like
PCs,
Dell.
So
definitely it's the PC world that's much more comfortable with integrating different parts from different manufacturers. Oh, I need more speed. Oh, well, I'll just upgrade my RAM. I don't need to buy a whole new thing.
They take longer to switch on, though.
Well,
like sometimes you have to wait 3 minutes.
And that's part of the operating system. So maybe try, you know, Ubuntu over like the Microsoft product, and you might find that your product's actually loading even faster.
Our black and white telly used to take a couple of minutes to warm up.
And then at the end of the day, did you watch it disappear to a little dot as they played the national anthem?
Yeah, definitely. I think they've got the job.
Definitely.
Janet, your cafes, how do people find them?
Well, we call ours parties, but it's the same thing.
Should I bring my vacuum cleaner?
Yeah, absolutely.
I've always wanted to take a vacuum cleaner to a party.
Where are they?
So we host events in London, all across London. We have a network of groups that host events in London, but anywhere in the UK, you can find a repair event near you. We list as many as we can across the UK.
So how do people go? They go to your website?
Yeah, the restartproject.org. Or you can look at the Repair Cafe International website. They also have events there.
Well, look, I'm convinced. Aren't you convinced?
Definitely, yeah. I'm quite excited about getting my vacuum cleaner fixed.
Can I put a plug in? Definitely. For so in the European Right to Repair campaign, we are we're pushing for smartphones to be included in Brussels' plans for the future, and there's a deadline coming up, and we'd really appreciate signatures on a petition. It's just repair.eu/smartphones. So.
And what about here?
Well, this is the thing, is that the European campaign incorporates Norway, for example. Right. So let's be positive and still be part of Europe and push where we can. And we can show that if, you know, in the UK, there's massive support for this, that that can also help quiet some of the other Eurosceptics in Brussels. So, yeah.
Okay. Janet and Duncan, thank you very much. We're coming to the cafe with our vacuum cleaners, our iPhones and our printers, aren't we?
Yeah.
I'm delighted to say that we're now joined by Adèle Chasson, who is Advocacy Manager at Halt à l'obsolescence programmée. Tell us the story behind your organization.
The NGO Halt à l'obsolescence programmée could translate in English to stop planned obsolescence. And it's a French NGO created in 2015, and its goal is really to unite as many citizens as possible to have more durable and repairable products by influencing both the law, the public decision makers, and also private companies towards this goal. There was really an opportunity when planned obsolescence was banned in the law in France in 2015 in an energy transition law, because it was the first country in the world to ever do that. And so it really gave citizens an opportunity to actually apply their rights and sort of punish companies who would do planned obsolescence.
And that's exactly what you did with Apple. Can you tell us about this case? They were fined €25 million by the French government for breaching this planned obsolescence law, and you brought that case against Apple. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, exactly. So we filed this complaint in the end of 2017 because we noticed that there were a lot of people experiencing malfunctions of their iPhones when they updated the operating system. So basically people had problems after updating their operating system. They had like their battery emptying very quickly, or just the phone in general being very slow. And we gathered over 15,000 testifies of people who had this kind of problems. And so we decided to file this complaint for planned obsolescence and also unfair commercial practices. And Apple was just fined €25 million by the French authorities after more than 2 years of investigation by the authorities. But unfortunately, the only thing we regret is that there won't be a public trial on the planned obsolescence. So that's the only downside to the situation, I guess.
And as you mentioned, in 2015, France passed a planned obsolescence law, which made it illegal to deliberately reduce the lifespan of products to encourage replacement. How did that come about?
So there were debates since maybe 2013 around how to make consumption more sustainable, etc. And one first step was a law about unconsumption in 2014, which already included several dispositions on spare parts, for instance. So spare parts had to be more easily accessible for repair, etc. There was also something about the legal guarantee of products, so to make it easier to apply. And what it changed is that when you had a problem with your guarantee, it was the manufacturer's job to actually prove that the problem didn't exist before and not the consumer's role. So that was very important to apply the guarantee in an easier way. And so I think at this time there were a big debates around planned obsolescence and if we can ban it or not. But it took more than 2 years to actually reach the law and become a reality. So it's good, but it took a while.
And do you think that was a social movement that made that possible, or was it, you know, because we're always interested in this podcast on how change happens as well as what change should happen. What do you think was the key thing that forced this change in the law?
I think it was a combination of things. There certainly is more awareness around planned obsolescence in France than in other countries. I think the term is more commonly known, and it's also the work of some senators, especially green ones, who worked on the topic and have been very, yeah, voluntary to put it in the law. So I think that's what made it happen.
You're not stopping at Apple. You've moved on to, or you are also bringing a case against the printer manufacturer Epson. Tell us about that.
So first we did an investigation on printers because when you think about planned obsolescence, it's one of the first products that comes to mind. And we had a lot of complaints about them. So we decided to actually investigate sort of what was going on, what were the problems or potential issues with durability, repairability of these specific products. For instance, are there faults that come back on every product, this kind of thing. So we released a report, and based on the evidence, we decided to file a complaint actually against several manufacturers, not only Epson. It's just the investigation focused specifically on Epson. And what one of the first or the most striking things that we noticed in our report is that sometimes when your printer tells you to change the ink cartridge, actually, the cartridge can sometimes still have up to 40% of the ink still inside.
Wow.
And this is a big problem because just of the price of the ink, which is about, in France, it's about 2,300 euros for a liter of ink, which is much more expensive than a lot of luxury perfumes, for instance. So that was one of the things that we noticed in base of our complaints.
Can you tell us about the anti-waste laws in France? It seems that they're more ambitious than many other countries. I know the French Parliament passed new laws in December. Can you tell us what those are and what the background is to this?
This was a quite important law, just voted in the Parliament in the end of December last year. This law actually followed a sort of roadmap for circular economy that was announced in France in 2018. And it has a very wide scope. It deals with waste and also premature obsolescence and production and consumption. And it was very much enriched by our members of parliament. And basically, one of the most important measures that were added is a durability scoring system to better recognize durable products. So starting 2024, when you go to a shop in France to buy an electronic product, you will have a score of 1 to 10 telling you how durable the product will be. So how repairable, how solid the materials will be. So if you have a phone that is 10 out of 10, then you can probably trust better that it's more durable than a phone that has a worse grade.
You've given me an idea, Adele. I mean, surely on the packages we should have like a health warning, this product can seriously damage the planet, which is the version of the health warning we have on cigarette packages, or there could be a sort of warning to consumers, couldn't there?
Yeah, exactly. Actually, that's one of our proposals. We published a white paper in February last year, and that was one of our proposals to put like a sort of message like we do in health messages to say like try to keep your products for a number of years before you dispose of it or even just think about donating it or selling it when you really want a new product, for instance.
I like the idea of that.
We have a utopia on the podcast called the Jeffocracy. If we were to invite you into this utopia...
I think it's not a very French tradition.
No, there'll be plenty of liberty.
No, but it's a very...
Egalitarianism.
I feel it's in the... in a
egalite, fraternity.
You're just trying to sort of bluster here. I feel like it's in a sort of monarchical tradition, but maybe Adele can bear
with us. You're
saying
I would be victim of a revolution?
Yeah.
But anyway, if we appointed you the head of
obsolescence,
yeah, combating built-in obsolescence, what is the first thing that in a government could be?
And you have complete power, Adele, in Jeff's Jeffocracy to do what you want.
one of the first things I would do is to put just mandatory norms on durability and repairability for a really wide range of products, because I think a lot of policy around planned obsolescence is directed at consumers. It's aimed at making consumers make better choices, etc. But it's important not to forget that it's also the responsibility of the manufacturer to make better products. And so to encourage that, I think we really need some actual constraints on spare parts have to be available for like 10 years. We have to have products that are easy to disassemble, etc. So I think it's important to really address the manufacturer's side and not only just believe in the free consumer choice that will solve everything.
Okay, well, that's very convincing. Adèle Chasson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So what did you think?
I mean, I'm delighted that I can take my vacuum cleaner somewhere to get it fixed. I know I'm not great at a party, but I think maybe a repair party could be the one
maybe
for me.
Maybe that's a way, the kind of party you want to go to, because it doesn't sort of, there's not a sort of socialization
there's
purpose.
There's a bit of purpose to the party, yeah, beyond just the socializing. But I do. I mean, I feel very guilty about some of the things we talked about.
Do you really, though?
Yes. Yeah, especially about buying a new printer.
Are you just saying that to impress our listeners?
No, I feel guilty because I bought a new printer because there was a paper jam. But I think a lot of people of, you know, my millennial generation, borderline millennial generation, do feel like we don't have those kind of skills that you people growing up post-war had.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Spirit of the Blitz. I think it's sort of encouraged me to think about this much more, but I think it's one of those things that happens sort of, you know, inside the black box. And so you don't quite think it through, that you just think, oh, well, Apple have come up with a nicer iPhone. You know, you don't really think about all of the sort of things that are going, you know, oh, I can't get it replaced, or, you know, I can't find an accessory. You don't
can't
really
change
think,
the battery.
Yeah, you don't, yep. you don't sort of think, well, this is all part of making you just buy lots more because it's their business model. I mean, that is part of the problem, isn't it?
It is.
It is their business model. But it does sound from the French experience that, you know, you can have an impact. And that rating system, the newly passed rating system, sound, I mean, I thought was quite impressed by that. Sounds like it could really make a difference.
Reasons to be Cheerful, a podcast about ideas with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you've got thoughts about what you've heard on this week's episode about the right to repair or ideas for future episodes, please go to our website, cheerfulpodcast.com. You can find ways to get in touch with us. Now, this one comes from somebody who'd prefer to withhold their name, but we think it's a really interesting email, and indeed one of a number of interesting emails we had about our episode, Man Enough, Promoting Positive Masculinity. Dear Ed and Jeff, I was thrilled to listen to this week's podcast on the subject of masculinity. It's a subject close to my heart as I helped run Men's Lib, an online men's forum dedicated to exploring masculinity in a positive and mutually supportive way. We were founded in 2015, a full 2 years before the Me Too movement, as a constructive response to the often hateful and misogynistic men's rights movement. Since then, we've grown to 113,000 members from all over the world and have held discussions on topics including mental health and suicide, domestic violence and paternity leave. We also maintain a wiki of organisations dedicated to helping men in as many countries as we can. We take our name from the men's liberation movement in the 1970s, which saw itself as aligned with feminism, not in opposition to it. I think the discussion around the much maligned term toxic masculinity was missing some historical context. Rather than being a recent feminist invention, it actually has its roots in the mythopoetic men's movement, mentioned briefly by Nathan Roberts at the end of your show. When the term was first coined, it had a more positive counterpart named deep masculinity, incorporating traits such as strength and self-reliance. If you're interested in finding out more, you can find us at www.reddit.com/menslib, where our weekly free Talk Friday threads are a good place to get to know us. Please don't hesitate to get in touch.
Right, this comes from Sam Hill. What the Sam Hill is going on here? It's what they say in films when they would be dubbing out the profanity.
Interesting.
Instead of what the hell. It says the podcast is really helping my PhD. Dear Jeff and Ed, hope you're both well. I discovered your podcast last year and just wanted to say it's been a great resource for me. I'm studying for a PhD in politics, and a lot of the topics that you've covered are very relevant to the things I'm discussing. It was a fantastic idea to add in discussion about how these big ideas could be implemented, and I look forward to hearing more. Also, while studying for my PhD, I work in a supermarket. It's normally quite a boring job, but one time, Ed actually came into the store.
Wow.
I thought it would be rude to ask him a load of questions about politics, so I got on with my job. However, as he was doing his shopping, he rammed me with his trolley. I don't think he realised... I don't like the thought of you being in charge of a shopping trolley, especially one of the ones with a squeaky errant wheel.
I think I need a sort of driving license.
Yeah. I don't think he realised, and I just left it. But now that moment is what I remember every time someone mentions him. Has Ed careered into you with a shopping trolley? Maybe a luggage trolley at a train station or an airport?
Oh, definitely. I'm sure
If so, let us know.
I'm sure that is possible.
We'll get a map of the world and then put a pin in every location that you've careened into someone.
Or spilt somebody. Spilt some kind of, you know, liquid substance.
Yeah.
Food. Or
any of the above, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but thanks for telling us about that, Sam Hill.
This one comes from Annabelle E. Gladstone Allen. What a great name. Hearing Jeff talk about finding podcasts which are a bit soporific, I never get to the end of an episode of Reasons to be Cheerful.
You miss our outros.
As I always... there's another bit, actually, to be fair. As I always fall asleep before I get to the end. Okay, Annabelle E. Gladstone Allen, this has got to get better. I always listen the next day.
Phew.
Fast forwarding to the last part, I do remember. Don't get me wrong, I love the podcast. I never miss an episode. I just always listen to it in two parts. Annabelle Gladstone.
Well, as long as you get into the bit where we labour over it every week.
We've never had a word of appreciation for our hopeless sort of
outro,
bad dad puns. Yeah. I mean, really.
Email us reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter @cheerfulpodcast or search for our Facebook page, Reasons to be Cheerful Podcast.
Now, in our cheerful people slot, I'm delighted to say that we're joined by Larry Sanders, older brother of Bernie Sanders, front runner for the Democratic nomination. Larry is lived in the UK since 1969. He gave an emotional speech casting his vote for Bernie Sanders in 2016. And we're talking to him ahead of the Democrats Abroad primary. Thank you so much for joining us, Larry.
Well, thank you for asking me. I'm very pleased to be talking with you.
Let's start at the sort of beginning, so to speak. What was it like growing up with Bernie, or Bernard, as I interestingly you called him?
It was very unexciting. We're a very kind of normal family.
What did your parents do, Larry?
My father was a paint salesman. He migrated from Poland in 1921 when he was 17 years old. It was only when my children were 17 that I realized what it meant for somebody to come without any money and any words of the language to a foreign country. So I hadn't appreciated when we were growing up what he faced. My mother was born in New York. Her parents came from Poland, all Jewish people, of course.
And what was it about your... We'll come on to Bernie's first election in a minute, but what was it about your childhood that sort of drove you both in different ways into the sort of political arena?
Well, it was not essentially from home. Our parents were not political animals. They were very deeply committed to and loved Franklin Roosevelt in the New Deal, but they didn't go to meetings or join groups or even read political material. On the other hand, I think it's fair to say that the depth of the political feeling amongst this huge Jewish migration to New York between 1880 and 1920, I guess, they were very, very left-wing. It was a combination of whatever they brought with them, and then they faced really kind of brutal capitalism, especially, you know, some of them had money, but the vast majority were like my father. And they were at the mercy of employers who were not nice. And I think that brought out all this pent-up emotion. But it was all aimed in one direction. It was said, what Bernard's slogan has become. Everybody's entitled to a decent life. Government is a vital part of creating that possibility. So we knew that. We absolutely knew that.
And Bernie's first election was, I gather, when he stood to be student body president at James Madison High School in Brooklyn. Tell us about
That's right. Well, that was a surprise to me. He hadn't talked about that sort of thing before. But he put himself up, and there were three candidates, all three boys. Bernard was the only one with a substantial platform. The others were fairly trivial school-type things, proms or whatever. Bernard had a program based on raising money for Korean orphans of Korean
This would have been the 1950s, is that right?
This is the... now, Bernard was in the late 50s.
Late 50s.
And you had probably millions of children who had lost their parents. The school system required payment, so they had no money to pay. They were really in a terrible situation. And Bernard read about it somewhere, and he made it his platform. And what's even more interesting, in a way, the person who won the election adopted the program. Bernard worked with him, and they raised a really substantial amount of money for that very good cause.
And then Bernie's career involved being the mayor of Vermont, then...
Of Burlington.
Of Burlington, Vermont, I beg your pardon. And then, obviously, the independent, self-described socialist congressman, is that right? And then senator?
That's right.
And then senator from Vermont.
Yes, that's right.
Would you have ever imagined him running for president at that point?
Did I imagine? No. I didn't imagine. But he made a huge impact. I mean, this when he was elected mayor, this was Reagan time. And the country was moving to the right and all that. He got actually national attention. He got onto national radio programs and things.
I mean, there is something very interesting, isn't it, about what it says, and we'll come on to Bernie's campaign about the political environment, because I was living in America in 1988. And
yes.
Michael Dukakis, who was the then nominee, spent the whole election being afraid to describe himself as a liberal. And today we've got Bernie as the front runner for the Democratic nomination. And different people have different views about whether he will get the nomination, whether he'll win the election. But as a self-described socialist, what do you, as a sort of, as his brother, but also as an observer of what is happening here and there and in the US, what do you think this sort of betokens?
Well, I think it means that the pundits are not really correct about their assessment of the populace. I think, but Bernard often says he's not a radical, or at least his policies are not radical. He may be radical. The things he wants of a good universal health care system, of a minimum wage that people can actually live on, free tuition for university and so on. They're pretty, if you put them to the polls, and the pollsters do these things in both countries, they're very popular. 60, 70, 80% people are in favor of them.
Larry, you've lived over here for 50 years. I was wondering what parallels you see or don't see between Bernie and Jeremy Corbyn, and perhaps then thinking about how things went for Jeremy Corbyn in the last election.
Well, there are similarities, particularly in domestic policy. I think a lot of Corbyn's policies and Bernard's policies are very close to each other. And some people have said it might be a bad sign for Bernard's election chances. I don't think so. First, because for whatever reason, Corbyn's personal approval ratings went down, were very low, and Bernard's tend to be either the highest or second highest. So that makes a big difference. And it also makes a big difference that the whole mess of Brexit, which made it very difficult for Corbyn to get his message across, doesn't exist in America.
Now, we're obviously talking to you as observers, keen observers and fascinated by what's happening in America, but also because US citizens living in the UK and elsewhere around the world who might be listening to this can vote in the Democrats abroad primary. Larry, tell us about that.
It's a very interesting system. Democrats abroad is like a small state, like Vermont. They have delegates to the Democratic Convention, and it's very simple to vote. If you're an American citizen, and you're living or studying in the UK or in any other country around the world, all you need to do is go to the website, democratsabroad.org, and it will tell you how you register on the spot, online, and how you can vote. Mostly online, the polls, you can vote right now, actually. It started from February 19th, and will close on March the 10th. In many cities, there are polling booths. If you go to Democrats Abroad, they'll tell you where you can vote if you would like to cast your vote in person.
Do you think he's going to win the nomination? Can he win the presidency?
Well, the hard part is winning the nomination, which I think he will do. I think he will destroy Trump. Trump is nothing but a puffed-up liar, and Bernard knows exactly where all the bits are buried. Trump promised working-class people who had been badly treated by both parties for many decades that he was going to do all sorts of great things for them. The only thing he's done is cut taxes for the extremely rich. All the rest of it was baloney. And Bernard's policies are good for the people who have been left behind, and I think he'll get it across, and I think he'll do extremely well.
And do you think he can attract the voters who aren't necessarily the most left-wing, Democratic-inclined voters? In other words, can he move, if he does get the nomination, from success in the primary to the sort of voters who might make the difference?
Well, Bernard's vote already is not by any means confined to people who identify themselves as very liberal or very left-wing. In fact, I think probably the most noticeable category that he's attracting is people with low incomes and young people. And young people keep getting older and older. I mean, I see he's leading up to the age of 50, which is not a usual definition of young.
I consider that young, but I
I consider it childlike.
Oh, well, thank you for you, Larry. Well, look, that is good. Well, Larry, look, we really appreciate you taking the time to join us. Thank you very, very much. I know you'll be probably staying up all hours watching debates and results. And it's a real pleasure to speak to you.
Oh, it's been very nice speaking to you. Thank you very much.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Oh, we're in the outro and you've got an email you're excited about.
Yes, we're having this competition to see who lives in an unusual place.
Most exotic location.
Yeah, Mark Oxley, I think is kind of going to be temporarily top of the leaderboard. It's entitled Message, All Right, You Asked for Furthest Listeners. So, I was listening to the 4-day week podcast while making hummus in my kitchen, and the cats ran around me while my partner slept in sunny Shenzhen, China. We're still in lockdown over the coronavirus, so I've turned to cooking to alleviate boredom. It's a city of 50 million people just a day trip away from sweaty Hong Kong. According to the website, I checked on the distance from my hometown in Yorkshire to Shenzhen, is a distance of nearly 11,400 miles.
That's extremely exciting.
Mark Oxley, wow.
It's good to know that we're not blocked by the Chinese government as well.
Yeah, let's say to the Chinese censors if they're listening.
Hi. Hello. Big shout out to the Chinese censors.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, and if they'd like to email in...
Yeah, I mean, you don't just need to compete on distance. It's interesting location and perhaps interesting activity. I mean, it was the hummus that made that for me.
You're a big hummus fan.
I love it. Just got to get the right amount of cumin in there, I think.
My older son, if you could only eat one thing all day, every day, you'd eat hummus.
Not doing much to shatter the myth of you being a stereotypical North London politician,
are you?
Not
really, no, I know. Look, but, you know, hummus is quite healthy, isn't it?
I think so. I mean... In moderation, you've got to moderate. Is there any hummus that you make your own sandwich shop?
I mean, now you mentioned it. Definitely.
We should thank our guests.
Why don't we thank our guests? I'd like to thank Janet Gunter, Duncan McCann, and Adele Chasson.
And thanks to...
Hey now!
What does that sign say? It says, applesauce. Only kidding, it says, applause. That's what Hank used to say at the beginning of every single episode.
Is that right?
I miss that show.
I do too.
It's due a rewatch.
Yeah.
If you've never seen it, treat yourself to the box set. It's anyway, astonishing television. But
thanks to Larry, Sanders. Brother of Bernie Sanders.
All right, then. He's been...
Emma Caution produced our podcast with backup and research from Joe Kenyon and Joel Pierce. Ed Seed did our music. James Deacon did our idents. And our artwork was produced by...
Henry Cole. Nothing for Gail Lofthouse this week, then.
And our announcer. was Gail Lofthouse. How could I forget? Just because I'm not as practiced as you are at doing the credits.
Apart from the fact that I completely forgot the credits and you had to wade in and save me.
Indeed.
So it's now time for everybody's favourite part of the podcast, our little sign-off.
He's been underground, overground, wombling free.
He's been the Wombles of Wimbledon coming away.
And these have been reasons to be cheerful.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.